Go ahead and turn to Nehemiah chapter 6. We started our review to get back up to where we were when we left off. Nehemiah, we got through chapters 1 through 5, and last time we were teaching, we had left off partway through chapter 6. So I'm going to pick up the rest of chapter 6. We talked about Nehemiah chapter 1 through 5 last week, and does anybody remember where we left off? Yeah, they're getting ready to put the doors up. Nehemiah chapter 1 was getting ready for this project. In Nehemiah chapter 2, after prayer, bathing it in prayer, Nehemiah gets the ball rolling. And then in chapter 3, he gets all the work organized. And you say, now why did it take you all last week to get through all that when you just did it in about 30 seconds? But then chapter 4, we found opposition. There was opposition from without. And again, the reminder there, even as we look at what we're going to look at this week, is anytime we do something for the Lord, we can expect from someplace there'll be opposition. And he is opposed in this great work that he's doing. And then in chapter 5, not only is the opposition from without, but where else does he get opposition? From within, because of all those people working together, folks had taken advantage of others financially and things weren't going well and there was grumbling and complaining. And you ever try and get a project done when there's grumbling and complaining going on? You know, it's nigh to impossible. So here Nehemiah is, and he's kind of taking and setting aside the work just briefly, and he deals with that issue and then gets back to the work. And then we get to this chapter 6. And Nehemiah chapter 6 really is the finishing the job. Again, you look at Nehemiah chapter 6, and as we work through it, you would almost think this ought to be the last chapter of the book of Nehemiah. Because Nehemiah is about what? What's the theme of Nehemiah? Yeah, they're building the wall. And we're going to find halfway through this chapter, they get to the end of it, and it's finished. So shouldn't the book be finished there? We're going to talk about that, because think about that as we get there. In fact, the interesting thing in chapter 6 is if you're not looking real close for the fact that they finished the wall, you could miss it. And I'm thinking, for 6 chapters, we've been building up to finishing this wall. So what is God up to and what is Nehemiah doing that we only find this short comment in here? Well, part of it is, again, as we get into this finishing the job situation, as he got close to the end of the job, we find in verses 1 through 4, now when Sanballat and Tobiah, Geshem the Arab, and the rest of the enemies heard that I had built the wall and that there was no breach left in it, although up to that time I had not set the doors and the gates, Sanballat and Geshem sent to me saying, come and let us meet together. And then it goes on to talk about this situation that's going on there. But the wall is finished except for, as Bruce had said, only one thing hasn't been completed on the wall. And what is it?
Doors.
Yeah, the gates aren't up. What's the problem with that?
It's free
access. Yeah, what good is the rest of the wall? You remember how many gates were in there? I should have counted them up. I didn't have them all counted up. But you remember how many gates were in the wall? You know, and what happens if there's no doors in the gates? What good is the rest of the work that they did? Because what was the purpose of building the wall for them? Now, the ultimate purpose was God's glory as they put the city back together. But what was their immediate purpose in building that wall?
Security.
Yeah, security, safety. And without the gates, it's not there. And I thought about that, and especially this topic in chapter 6 of finish the job, because I thought about the fact that how many of you have projects at home that you got a lot of work done, but you never quite got them finished, and they still need to be finished up? You know, almost every one of us has a project like that at home, don't we? You know, Bruce has offered to help you finish him up. So if you need help, no, don't. But I thought about that even today because I thought I've got so many projects going and it's easy to get almost to the end and get enthusiastic about a project. But what is it that often keeps us from finishing the job when we're doing projects?
Time.
Time always gets in my way. The problem with me is it always takes me more time than I anticipate it taking. Has that ever happened to you? I finally figured out it's because I'm not an expert, and I allow myself the time an expert should take to do it, and I should multiply that by 12, and I make it closer to where I'm supposed to be. So time is one reason. Why else don't we finish projects often?
Materials.
Distractions. We're going to talk about that. You ever get distracted? Because we're going to talk about that this morning. In fact, that's the first thing we're going to talk about, so we'll go ahead and slide there. I wasn't going to yet, but distractions. Nehemiah is going to face distractions even though this wonderful project is almost done. And as I was trying to think about, as I went through this again this morning, was going over it early in the morning, I opened up the back door to our deck and they had the screen there and the birds were singing and the rain wasn't falling for a change. It was kind of a nice change of pace this morning. And as I watched that, Suddenly our birds started flying back in, and we've got a pair of cardinals that are coming in, and they flew in this morning. And they flew in and they looked, and the bird feeder was totally empty. So here I am working on my Sunday school lesson, and I looked up, and I knew I only had enough time to review my lesson and my morning message and get ready and get to Sunday school on time. And I looked up, and suddenly I see these birds, and you know what's going through my mind? Yeah, these poor birds, I ought to be feeding them. You know, and I even tried to wake my wife up and have her go feed the birds, and she looked at me like, are you crazy? I keep looking down at my lesson, but you know what's in the back of my mind? That's just terrible at the end of the storm that we don't have more food in there for the birds. Now, they eat us out of house and home, so they really are Obama birds, I think. You know, they come and they're entitled, and they just take it all away and come back and complain when it's not there, and they sing even louder when it's empty. But I looked at that, and I thought, I got to do something about that. Well, finally, I just said, no, I can't get distracted. I got to work on my lesson. So as I'm working on my lesson, I wanted to look something up, and I went to go on the internet, and my computer tells me that I have no internet connection. And I'm like, well, why don't I? And so I look, and it's the internet at home isn't showing up on my computer. And so a while back, we got rid of our landline internet because it wasn't working very well up where we live, and we just have a wireless that works through our wireless plan with our phones. And there's a little MiFi, they call it, sitting on the counter that basically controls the internet for the house. And I walked over there quick and I look at it, and it's the back has almost popped off of it. And my first thought was, shame on me, but my first thought was, did my wife knock this over this week and not tell me? So I'm looking at this thing thinking, I should be doing my lesson. I really don't have to look up what I was going to look up. And I'm getting distracted again. And I found out that you're not supposed to leave those things plugged in all the time. That's when it says 100% charge to unplug them. If you don't, the battery swells. And sure enough, the battery swelled, popped the back off, and I'm lucky it didn't blow up. So I unhooked all that, got back to my lesson, and I thought, distractions. How many projects never get finished because of distractions? And that's what Nehemiah is going through here. What's happening in verses 1 through 4? Sanballat and Tobiah hear that the wall is almost finished. They've been opposing this wall all the way through. So what did they do when they found out the wall was almost finished except for the gates? Did they give up? Did they walk away from the situation? Did they say, oh, hey, we tried, you know, we did our best to stop them, but they're going to finish this anyway? What did they do in verses 1 through 4? Yeah, they try to pull Nehemiah away from the project. Look here. Even it says, I am doing a good work, is what he tells them in verse 3, and cannot come down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and come down to you? Because they say, hey, let's get together and talk about this. Let's have a meeting. Were these the kind of folks that Nehemiah needed to spend a lot of time talking with about the wall? Yeah, and he even perceived through all, they intend to do him harm. Because what has been their objective all along? Stop the wall. What's Nehemiah been trying to do all along? Build the wall. And as he's just getting to the end of it, they're like, well, if we can only distract him and do him harm and attack the leader who's got a vision for this, then we can stop the wall before the gates go in. And if we stop the wall before the gates go in, we win. And so here they are trying to distract him. Now, did they just try once and then Nehemiah said, you know, I can't come down? And they said, well, that didn't work. What does the scripture tell us if we look down in this verse, in these verses? Verse 4, and they sent to me four times this way. Again, I think we talked about this last time. I remember this when I was raising kids, especially teenagers. They'll come and they'll say, can I? And usually that's about what they got out of their mouth, and I would say no. I figured I'd get the groundwork laid and then work from there, you know, find out what they really wanted. And so they'd say, can we do this? And I'd say, no, that's not a good idea. So what invariably happened an hour later? You know, and it's interesting that there's four, because I had four kids, you know. So if the first one didn't get it, the second one came with the second request, same request. Can we? No, you can't do that. So it should have been over, shouldn't it? Except now I've got the third one coming. And the third one comes. Can we? No, you can't do that. So then they got really, dad likes his daughter. He only has one daughter. She's the cute young one. We'll send her even though she doesn't care if we do it or not. And so then she would come and you'd have to say, no, you can't do it. What happens every time you stop to say no? Distracted. You get distracted. So they keep sending these requests, trying to distract Nehemiah, but Nehemiah continues to say no and gets right back to the work. He's focused on the work. And again, I thought about that because is it possible for us to have great intentions of doing things in the church? Great intentions of doing things for the Lord? You ever set out with a goal to do something for the Lord in some year or another? Especially, we do this a lot of times at the beginning of the year and say, you know, this year I'm going to, and fill in the blank. And by April 1st, if not before, what happens? You get distracted. Was it a good idea? Yeah, it was a great idea. Did you have good intentions when you set up to do that? Yeah, you had good intentions, but what happens somewhere along the way if you're not careful? Why do we get distracted? What's the bottom line on why we get distracted, and what can we learn from Nehemiah?
He answered the phone.
Yeah, he answered the phone. What answer did Nehemiah give him? Four times he gave him the same answer, and what was it? No. How many of you like to say no when people ask you things? Because what happens when you tell somebody no? Sometimes there's guilt. What kind of reaction do you get?
Anger.
Sometimes you get anger. Anything else?
I know a couple that can be pretty pitiful.
Yeah, sometimes you get this pitiful look. Like, I can't believe you do this to me. You get this disappointment from people. So how many of you like to disappoint people on a regular basis? Yeah, a few of us, you know, we're built that way. But most of us don't like to disappoint folks. And so what do we say even when we shouldn't?
Do not call
list. Yeah, do not call. So they don't pay any attention to those anymore. You know that? And I think I figured out why. I'm not too bright. You know, I called the do not call list. I put my number on the do not call list. Worked for a little while. Suddenly they start calling me. I get online. I say, what do you do when they call you on the do not call list? Well, you got to call this number and report them, and then they'll check on it. And in the meantime, you're getting 15 more calls. And I thought, if I called everybody and reported them, they called me that shouldn't have, I'd never get anything done in life. So they get away with it. But often we get into these funks of being distracted because we say yes to things that we never should say yes to. Because we don't stay focused. And we've got to stay focused if we're going to reach the goals that we have, because good intentions aren't enough, are they? You know how I know good intentions aren't enough? I laugh about this every year. I keep thinking, maybe I should get a membership to the health club so I'll exercise on a regular basis. Now, when it gets nice, I like to run outside, and, well, I call it running. Most people call it plodding or barely moving, but I'm going in the same direction for a while. And I watch in, like, January. You know, January, down the road here, there's Planet Fitness. You know what that parking lot is like in January? It is full to the brim. People are driving around trying to find a parking space. And I look at that, and every time I come by, I'll look at that with my wife's in the car, and I'll laugh, and I said, you just watch. By February, what's the parking lot look like?
Empty.
Yeah, it's a lot more empty. By this time of the year, you drive by on their way to church, there's a half a dozen cars in the parking lot. What happened? Is everybody fit and trim now? Is everybody athletically where they wanted to be? Is everybody health-wise where they want to be now? What happened?
Lost their goal.
They lost their goal, they lost their focus, and they got distracted. Other things took place of that. Sometimes it's just a matter of you're laying there in bed and thinking, I'd rather sleep than go work out for an hour. You know, but whatever it is, distractions come. And that's what the first thing that happens with Nehemiah, and what we learn is, as we're going through this, is sometimes we've just got to discern what's really going on there and say no. Did Sanballat and Tobiah have Nehemiah's best interests at heart? No, not at all. Now, this isn't always the case, but often when somebody asks us to do things that distract us from what we ought to be doing for the Lord, do they have our best interests at heart? Whose interests do they have at heart? Their own. Now, are there times we ought to help other people? Yeah, are there times we ought to say no? And what's the problem? Discernment that we have to have. And that is one of the things we're going to see, and we've already seen with Nehemiah. Again and again, Nehemiah exercises discernment. When there was trouble in the body and there was opposition from within, did Nehemiah stop the work to deal with that? Say, maybe he's asking a trick question because he's talking about being distracted. But he did stop, didn't he? When Sanballat and Tobias said, come meet with us, he didn't stop. What was the difference? Yeah, exactly. He looked at what was going on, and in his discernment, Nehemiah said, if we let this stuff go on internally and all this fussing and fuming going on and all this feuding going on, we're never going to get the wall finished. This is keeping us from taking care of the job that God gave us to do. When Sanballat and Tobiah said, hey, come meet with us. We want to talk about this wall thing and see if we can get together on this. Was there anything in that for the wall or for Nehemiah or for the people of God? No. And so he said, no. And those are the kind of things we have to be able to do with our lives if we're going to get to where God wants us to be, because our time is limited. Our attention span is limited. Some of us more limited than others when it comes to attention span. But we need to know how and when to say no. Now we get to the end of verse 4 with all of this distraction. And he said, they sent to me 4 times and I answered them in the same manner. So is that the last we hear of Sanballat and Tobiah? Unfortunately, no. Because they're not done opposing God's work here, even though it's almost finished. So what we find in verses 5 through 9 is they take the slander and gossip. Look at verses 5 through 9. It says, in the same way, Sanballat for the 5th time sent his servant to me with an open letter in his hand. In it was written, it is reported among the nations, and Geshem also says it, that you and the Jews intend to rebel, and that is why you're rebuilding the wall. According to these reports, you wish to become their king, and you have also set up prophets to proclaim concerning you in Jerusalem, this is the king in Judah. And now the king will hear of these reports, so come now and let us take counsel together. So what happens in verses 5 through 7? What's the next tactic that Sanballat takes?
Slander.
Slander. Gossip. How do we know he wanted to spread the gossip? Because he sends a letter. So how do we know he's trying to spread that gossip and cause problems for Nehemiah? There's a couple things in there. How does he send in the letter? By messenger. What else does it say about the letter? He sent an open letter by messenger. Okay, now be honest. If I hand you an open letter, just fold it in half, and said, this is very critical, and it's very important, and it's got very sensitive information in it, and I don't have time, so can you take this to Greg? And I hand you this open letter. What are you going to do with it? Let's be honest. Most of us are going to get curious, and we're going to look at it. I thought about that because I thought, no, if he sent me, I'm going to look at this letter that's not sealed up and think, you know what, if he didn't want me to know what was inside, he could have put it in an envelope and sealed it, couldn't he? I used to send stuff home. I remember as an administrator, I used to send stuff home. And I'd send letters home to parents that weren't for the eyes of the children, but send them home through the children. And I used to send them in envelopes, thinking that'll do it. But you know what I found out? Kids aren't stupid. They know where to buy envelopes. They would open the envelope, read the letter, put it back in a new envelope, stick it, seal it, and take it to their parents. So I started putting it in envelopes and writing my name across the back flap of the envelope and letting them know in the letter that I'd done that, because if they open up that envelope and put it in a new one and they sign it, the signature on the envelope doesn't look anything like the one in the letter. And suddenly parents were getting the idea, because I didn't want the kids reading what was inside of that for one reason or another. Now, could Sanballat have sent the letter to Nehemiah that way if he was really concerned about what Nehemiah was up to? Sure, but nothing in that letter was true, was it? So here we have this slander and gossip. Now, if you're the messenger, now this would never happen in a Baptist church, okay? But if you're the messenger and you get this tidbit of information, and you're reading this and saying, oh, I had no idea Nehemiah was up to all this. What do you do with that information? You are an evil man, John Lewis. You would call your neighbor and share it. You and Janet both are sharing that with somebody. Why would you do that? Why do we do that with information at times? Now you're really playing with fire back there. It's a prayer request. I've got it. But even in that context, do we not need to be careful with information at times? And what is it about information like that we feel like we've just got to share it? Why does it happen? Why didn't the messenger, why did he look at it the first place? Okay, curiosity. He had to know. Suddenly he had a piece of information that he knew and nobody else knew. So why did he share that? Self-important. Is there a little bit of pride in there when we gossip? I know something you don't know. You need to listen to me. Why else does gossip spread?
Sometimes vindictiveness.
Sometimes vindictiveness. Why do you think Sanballat wrote that letter? He couldn't get Nehemiah any other way, so what was he going to do? He's going to attack his character. Was it true? Did that matter as it started to get spread around? Now his character is at least called into question. What else is there about gossip that makes it so dangerous?
Well, it's a power play, too, in a way. I know something you don't know.
Yeah, it's a power play. That's good.
People always believe certain parts of gossip. I mean, even without the truth. So that's dangerous. You build on that.
Isn't there a part of our nature, our human nature, not our godly nature or our spiritual nature, but isn't there a part of our nature that likes to be in the know about the dirt on somebody else? And again, doesn't that somewhat go to pride? Because if you're stumbling and I'm not in that area, how does that make me feel?
You're up here
now. I'm doing okay and you're not. And none of us are prideful, are we? You know, and I thought about that, because why do we spread gossip? And why did Sam Ballard know that this would be an effective manner for attacking Nehemiah? Because human nature is the fact that we like to spread things around. And how do we know when we're spreading gossip? You know, if you start out with a conversation, you say, you know what I just heard? You know what normally follows the dot, dot, dot after that?
Incorrect information.
Yeah, incorrect information, often gossip. Or somebody just told me. And again, when you're gossiping, what kind of tone does it take?
Usually self-righteous.
It's always
self-righteous.
It's negative.
It's almost always negative. And how is it often happening? You know, does Greg get up before leading the first song in Sunday school and say, I got a good juicy piece of gossip for you this morning, and spread it out to everybody? You know, how does it happen? Yeah, if somebody's talking in hushed tones or calling you on the QT and got to tell you something that they just heard, shouldn't red flags be going off, bells be going off, whistles be going off? But often, what's the reaction? I don't want to be the only one who's not in the know. Who uses that? Isn't that our media? You know, think about the media. Look what we just dug up. If somebody's going to win a Pulitzer Prize, how are they going to win it? Normally, by digging up dirt nobody else found and spreading it so everybody, bring it to the light of day. Sometimes it's not even true. And so here you've got Nehemiah, and he has to deal with this because Sanballat has attacked him. And in what ways has he attacked him in this, in verses 6, 7, and 8? His character, in what way? Putting it into the story, in what way has he attacked his character?
He's trying to say that he's wanting to be the king, and that he's just trying to ruin his reputation.
And why is that such a terrible thing? Putting it into the story.
Because he left the king. He was the king's cupbearer.
He left the king. He was the king's cupbearer. How did the king treat him?
Good.
Wonderful. Due to the grace of God and all the prayer that went into it, he did abundantly beyond anything Nehemiah could have expected from him and setting him up to do that work. And the gossip was going very right against the grain of that, and saying, after all that king did for you, you're trying to depose him and set yourself up as king in Jerusalem. What else did it say about his character here?
He plans to rebel.
Is he doing it all by himself? What else did they charge him with here?
Inciting others against
him. Yeah, you've got all of these prophets that you're going to have come and be a part of this thing that you're doing. So they're not only accusing Nehemiah of doing something wrong, but what else are they saying?
They're saying the Jews too.
You're dragging all these other folks into it with you. You are not a good man. And so Nehemiah is up against all of this. Now, I hope you haven't read ahead too far, because what would you do at that point? What do folks often do when they find themselves on the wrong end of gossip?
They try to defend themselves, but it's usually not a good idea, because the more you oppose that, the more they believe against you.
Yeah, and when we try to defend ourselves, if we find the source of the gossip, what's the usual manner of trying to defend ourselves?
Anger.
We get angry. If I know... I'll pick on Greg since he's sitting up in the front. He won't sit up in the front anymore. But if I know that Greg started a rumor, gossip about me that wasn't true, and somebody tells me that Greg did that, what is our normal, not what we should do, but what is our normal course of response to that many, many times?
Tell everybody what Greg did.
Can you believe what Greg did to me? And not only do we give the story out about what Greg did to us, but what happens in the midst of that often? Is it enough just to say Greg said something that wasn't true about me? Do we stop there? Yeah, now we've got a Greg story going. If you think what he said about me, which was wrong, by the way, you know, is bad, let me tell you about the source of your information. And we spread slander and gossip that way. And that's why gossip is so destructive, because it's going back and forth. Now, putting it in the context of what we ought to do, if I know that something's been said wrong about me and I know who said it, what am I supposed to do? Go to those people. Go to that person and confront him. Then whose responsibility is it to straighten it out, even if he reacts properly and says, you know what, I shouldn't have done that? Who's supposed to straighten that out? Do I have to write all the people that I thought Greg talked to get it right? No, Greg's got to straighten that out. Before God, that's his responsibility. I just need to take care of it and say, you know, this isn't true. Well, look what Nehemiah does. Because if Nehemiah starts tracking this down and fighting against Sanballat and Tobiah, and Nehemiah have legitimately said, let me tell you about Sanballat and what he's really like. This guy was a wretched guy. We found it out already in Scripture. He could have attacked him any number of ways. But look what happens here as we continue going down through here. Then I said to him, saying, no such things as you have said have been done, for you are inventing them out of your own mind. For they all wanted to frighten us, thinking their hands will drop from the work and it will not be done. But, O God, strengthen my hands. So who does Nehemiah confront?
The source.
He goes back and tells Sanballat, none of this is true. You made it all up. What else does he do?
He prays about it. Goes back to God about it.
He goes back to God and he prays about it. Why'd he do that? The slander's already out there. He's already set Sanballat straight. Why does he pray about it?
It's a source of power.
It's a source of power? Yeah, George.
God commissioned him to do that to begin with, so he goes back to the source.
Yeah, he goes back to the source. And as I looked at that, I had to ask myself the question, can I trust God with my reputation? Did the folks know what kind of man Nehemiah was? Did the people in Jerusalem who had worked with him for almost 2 months now, did they know what kind of man they were working with? So as these rumors go out, Nehemiah goes to the source and says, that's not true. And he prays to God. And look at his prayer. What's the gist of his prayer here?
He's asking for strength.
He's asking God to strengthen what? His hands. Isn't that a little bit of a strange prayer as a result of gossip? Why did he do that?
So they can beat him up.
So that would be my response to it, so they could beat him up. I'm not sure that's quite theologically correct. They deserved it. He had a job to finish. What's the problem with gossip? One of the problems. Yeah, if you're gossiping about me and I come in Monday morning to do the work that God's given me to do, where's my mind? I gossip, and if I'm not careful, I'm suddenly calling people to defend myself and writing letters and getting on blogs and all kinds of things, tweeting and all the stuff that we do nowadays to defend ourselves. And at the end of the day, how much of God's work gets done? None. And Nehemiah looks and he says, you know what? What you're saying is not true. God strengthened my hands so I will stay focused to do what you have called me to do. You know anybody who ever got sidetracked from their living for the Lord because gossip caught them from behind and tripped them up? And sometimes they never get back on track. Because if we're not careful, again, and we're going to go on in just a second, but with gossip especially, if you're not careful as a Christian who's living for the Lord, and think about Nehemiah, was he living for the Lord? You're trying to do your best to get things done, to see God move forward, and to be where you ought to be with God, and suddenly somebody gossips about you, and who do you blame in the end? First, I get mad at the guy who's gossiping about me, but at the end of the day, as I'm praying, isn't it easy to say, God, how did you let this happen? Is God in control or isn't he? Did God know that was going to happen to Nehemiah? Yeah, did God intend for Nehemiah to be slandered? You know, God's not the author of the sin, but he knows what's going on. And so Nehemiah does what? He takes it right back to God and says, God, you take care of this. Strengthen my hands to do what I've been called to do. Yeah, Lainey.
I think if you look at big picture, it's the battle between good and evil. And Satan is known as the slanderer, right? So
oh, yes.
You know the source of where it's coming from. That always really will help. I think if you know the source, you can see behind the person.
Very good.
The other thing that he prays about for God to strengthen his hands, when the story first starts, there's a great part of verse chapter 2, verse 8, at the end of it, it says, the king granted these things to me because the good hand of my God was upon me.
Mm.
And so he, you know, he's relating it's God's work, it's God's hand behind it. My hands are the hands that God is using.
And what a perspective to have on that, because what was Nehemiah's ultimate objective again? You remember we talked about that? Building that wall, what was his ultimate objective? God's glory. And who was doing the work? God's good hand was upon him. So if the wall's finished and the gates goes up, who gets the glory? God does. You think Nehemiah was running around the town telling everybody how wonderful he was and putting all these things together? I guarantee you those folks know it. Working with Nehemiah knew about the good hand of God upon him. Can you imagine Nehemiah when he started talking to those men who were working with him about how it came to the point where he was that day? You know how I got, let me tell you about how God worked on my behalf. How God worked in the heart of the king. How the king supplied all this stuff because God directed him to do that. And so all of this is going on and distraction doesn't stop him. Slander doesn't stop him. He learned to trust the Lord for the strength to continue. That's where he asked him for the strengthening of his hands. And then threats. They don't stop with just the slander. They go to threats. Look at verses 10 through 14. It says here, now I went into the house of Shema, the son of Deliah, son of Mehethabel, and he was confined to his house, and he said, let us meet together in the house of God within the temple. Now if it stopped there, is there a problem yet? Now here's this guy who said, Nehemiah, let's meet in the temple. But why does he want him to meet? Continue looking at this verse. He says here, let us close the doors of the temple, for they are coming to kill you. They're coming to kill you by night. Is that a real problem for Nehemiah? In his day? The gates aren't up yet. Sanballat and Tobiah have tried everything else, so now they're threatening to kill him. Is that a real threat? Yeah, I think that was a real threat. That wasn't just gossip flowing around. And so here comes this priest and says, come on, let's go into the temple and hide in the temple. Why in the temple? It was, even in the time of Jesus, the greatest fortification in all of Jerusalem was the temple. And when the Romans came in 70 AD, now see, you got a different temple at that point, but when the Romans came in 70 AD to tear down Jerusalem, one of the last places they went was the Temple Mount and tore down the temple because that was their stronghold. That was their fortress. And so he said, come into the temple and hide with me in the temple. And Nehemiah answers him in verse 11 and said, such a man as I run away, and what man such as I could go into the temple and live? I will not go in. And I understood and saw that God had not sent him, but he had pronounced the prophecy against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. For this purpose he was hired, that I should be afraid and act in this way and sin, and so give me a bad name in order to taunt me. Remember Tobiah and Sanballat, O my God, according to these things that they did, and also the prophetess Noadiah and the rest of the prophets who wanted to make me afraid. So how does Nehemiah react to this? He turns to God. Does he flee to the temple?
No.
Why not?
That would be sin.
And why would that have been sin? And he said it would be. How could I sin against sin in this way? Why would that have been sin? There's a couple different nuances to it, but...
Well, he knew God was providing for him and protecting him.
Okay, so for him to run to the temple and hide, what does that say about the protection of God in his life? And what did he told people back in chapter 4? You remember what happened in chapter 4 when they threatened everybody working on the wall? Did Nehemiah let them all go hide at their houses? Now, what did they do?
Half on board and half guard.
Yeah, they were guarding, they were working, and even those who were working, some had a sword in one hand and a trowel in the other. And suddenly when Nehemiah is threatened, if he runs to the temple and hides, what does that say about him as a leader? I want you to trust God, but I'm not trusting God. I'm going to trust in the fortifications at the temple. Now, there's other things that I've read as I went through there about the fact that he shouldn't have been in the temple, or he wanted him to hide in the Holy of Holies, and he wasn't allowed there. But the bottom line is, Nehemiah looked at that temple situation and said, that is not what I can do as a man of God. Now, what else does he do? It's happened so many times in this book, it almost seems redundant. But what else does he do? He prays. And what does he pray this time? Last time, Tobiah is going after him with gossip and other things, and he prays, God, strengthen my hands. He's got a little different nuance on his prayer this time. What does he pray this time?
Ask God to remember what they did and done to him.
Now, what does he really say? Remember, does he think God's forgetting what Tobiah's doing? You know, God, I think you forgot, so remember this. What does he mean when he said, remember what's going on?
He's the judge.
Yeah, he's leaving this in whose hands? God's hands. Does Nehemiah have every legitimate right from a human perspective to get even with Tobiah? That guy has been wretched to him since he got there. But Nehemiah looks and he says, what, God, you remember. Why would Nehemiah do that? Or why could Nehemiah do that? His faith. And why? I want to get a little deeper than that, but it is his faith. His faith in what way? Since all the way back in the temple, he has seen God's hand at work, has he not? He saw him provide. He saw him give him safe travel from the palace all the way to Jerusalem. He saw him raise up these men in Jerusalem that had been sitting in this rubble for so long and take up the work. And not only take up the work, but if we look in chapter 4, it said that they finished the wall to the half of it because the people had a mind to work. Their hearts and minds were in it as God moved in their lives. And now he has a crisis about himself personally. And what's the temptation when the crisis hits home? When you're the one who gets the bad word from the doctor about your health. When you're the one who has a huge financial turnaround in your life and things are tight.
Have doubt.
We doubt?
Fear.
Fear. Isn't that what Nehemiah said? You know, you did this so that I would be afraid. Why is doubt and fear so dangerous?
Because it's a form of unbelief.
Yeah, it's definitely a form of unbelief. And what does that unbelief do to us? Okay, makes us try to take control. And whose project was this? It's God's project. What else does fear often do to us?
Cripples.
Yeah, it cripples us. It keeps us from doing what we ought to be doing. You know, why did Nehemiah have to get all the folks together in chapter 4 and come up with a plan for protection as well as work? What would have happened if Nehemiah said, I just ignore those threats coming from out there from Tobiah about coming in and messing with your villages and messing with your houses and just keep building? What are the builders going to do? What are the volunteer builders here going to do? Yeah, they're going to go back home and take care of things. So he put things together in order that the fear wouldn't be there. And so as Nehemiah is personally attacked, he's tempted with the same thing the people were tempted with. And he said, no, I can't fear. I can't fear because of God. Because I know what God is doing and God's in control. So all of these threats, should a man such as I run away? What is Nehemiah saying by that? Is Nehemiah arrogant here? What is he trying to say? Could this be taken arrogantly? I don't need to run. I got it all under control. Is that what he's trying to say? Now, what's Nehemiah trying to say here?
That they have a great big God.
Yeah, I have a great big God, and that great big God is taking care of everything. He's taking care of me. And I think that me is an important part as we look at that. Because if I asked you this morning, do you have a great big God? How many of you have a great big God this morning? If you're not raising your hand, you don't know your God, okay? We have a great big God. Can God meet every need in this room? Yeah, isn't that easy to say? Now, what about the struggle you're facing this morning? Can God meet that? We say yes, but sometimes don't we say yes just a little less emphatically than we did about everybody else's needs that we knew that God was going to take care of so they shouldn't be worrying? Because what do we often do afterwards? God will take care of my needs, so I'm going to worry about it because I'm going to help him out. Worry helps God get things done, doesn't it? And I mean, that's exactly where they wanted Nehemiah. Worry about what's going on. Worry about your life. Worry about the slander and these threats. And Nehemiah said, I'm going to refuse to worry about all these things because of God. It's not such a man as I because of this man. Should such a man as blessed as I have been with God's hand upon my life doubt him now? And doesn't that put a whole different light on what's happening, not only in Nehemiah's life, but in our lives? Because I guarantee you, if you're not being challenged with that now, that challenge is coming. Somewhere down the road, there's going to be a challenge coming on your walk in life where you're going to have to trust God because you can't do anything about it. And that's where our faith comes into play. And that's where we see the great faith of Nehemiah when he said, should such a man as I run away? He left the situation in the hands of God. Is there any better place to leave the situations of our lives? Yeah, George.
When David was in great trouble, he said, I will bless the Lord. I mean, the enemy's right there. He could be killed any moment. He says, I will bless the Lord.
And how does he do that? He's seen God work before. He can recount the great things that God has done for him. So there we are as we go through that. We've got the threats. We've got everything going on. So with all of that going on, we get to verse 15, and it's amazing what we find. It's amazing in a couple ways. It still amazes me because I had to dig to find it. Because this whole book is pointing toward what? It's headed toward what? The wall being completed. So I would think that by the time we get the wall completed, we're going to have big fanfare of everything. And Nehemiah, at least at this point in the book, doesn't do that. I had to look to find it. Look at what happens here. He's talking about all the way that God has worked and kept him through all this. And then it says in verse 15, so the wall was finished on the 25th day of the month of Elul in 52 days. And? Where's the rest of the fanfare? Now, there is some fanfare coming, okay? So I got to be honest. If you look at it, but it's with the people and their rejoicing that's going to come. But I got to verse 15, and, you know, if I were Nehemiah, and it's a good thing I wasn't Nehemiah, because Nehemiah's walk with God is so deep, and I think I need to be more like that every day. But I look at that, and I think, what would happen to you if you were Nehemiah in verse 15? And the wall was finished. Yeah, get pumped up. And if you're not careful, suddenly it's look what I accomplished. And up until this point, everything that's happened, Nehemiah's given the credit to the good hand of God that was upon him. And it's almost like he gets to verse 15, and it's just a matter of fact. Well, of course the wall was finished, because whose wall was it? Who provided for that wall? Who took care of the workers? Who gave Nehemiah the discernment to work through all those problems? Who worked in the heart of those rich folks when they were taking advantage of people to say, you know what, we're going to give that money back? That just blows my mind. And how did that happen? God did all that. And so we get to verse 15, and we say, so the work was finished in the 25th day of the month of Elul in 52 days. That we could talk about how that's a miracle in and of itself. All the physical labor that went into that with people who are not skilled laborers to do that work. And in 52 days, the work is done. The gates are in place. Everything's finished. What a wonderful testimony. And shouldn't the book end there? Shouldn't there be a period there? End of problems. End of issues. God gets the glory. We all go home. And we'd be done 10 minutes early, like I promised. But it doesn't end there, does it? Look at verse 16. It says in verse 16, and when our enemies heard of it, and all the nations around us were afraid and fell greatly in their own esteem, for they perceived that this work had been accomplished with the help of our God. What's happening in that verse? There's a couple things happening there. What's happening in the hearts of the enemies? Yeah, so what did that do to them?
Got them disheartened.
Yeah, were they having a good day? No, they were disheartened. The very thing they tried to do to the people of Israel and to Nehemiah happens to them in verse 16. Because they look and they see the walls go up in 52 days, which is a miracle. They see them persevere in the midst of all that opposition, which is a miracle. And what's their reaction to it at the end of that verse? They're disheartened because they knew what? God did it. And what was Nehemiah's objective to begin with? God be glorified. And I looked at that, and I had to say, as I've been praying about some things and asking God to give vision on some things we're doing here, you know, we need a vision that at the end of our vision, when we get to work and see God work through our church, people look and say, God did that. And I was talking to somebody just this week, because you come in as a new pastor, and what do you want to see? What do you think a new pastor wants to see coming in?
Growth
and people filling the pews and all these. And what do people expect when a new pastor comes? Growth and people coming in the pews. And if it doesn't happen after a few months, what do folks normally start thinking? Something's wrong here. Is this guy not the pastor for us? Why isn't this working better? Did Nehemiah have those kind of problems? And I looked at that and I thought, but Nehemiah turned that over to God, because whose work was it? It was God's work. And at the end of all of it, and I thought about that because I thought about the fact, you know, it would have done my heart good to have 16 families join the first year I was here. You know what the problem with that is? It would have done my heart good. And you know what I would have been thinking? Look what I accomplished. That hit me this week. I'm sorry to have to bore you with it, but it hit me because I'm going through this book saying, God, teach me through Nehemiah. And I looked and I said, but then you know what I thought about right after that? God, if I can get over myself, it's been long enough now. If stuff starts happening, who's going to get the credit now? If y'all start going out and people start coming in and we see God work, that's God's credit. And I shared with somebody, I don't even remember who I shared it with this week, but I shared with somebody that very thing, that my prayer right now is something happens here in our church so that people have to look and say, God did that, only by the grace of God. And that's where Nehemiah brings everything together here. And you get to verse 16, and couldn't there have been a period at the end of that for the book? Let's stop there. Wall is finished. Enemies are disheartened. God gets the glory. That's a Hallmark movie. You know, all's well that ends well. The girl ended up with the right guy. The wrong guy, he's over there discouraged and disheartened. It's, all the elements are there, except what happens in verse 17. Moreover, in these days, the nobles of Judah sent many letters to Tobiah, and Tobiah's letters came to them. What were they doing? What were they thinking? Who lost in this battle over the wall? Tobiah. He lost. So what are the nobles doing? They're sending letters to Tobiah. And Tobiah's sending letters to them. There's trouble in the camp. Okay, and it keeps going on. Look at verses 18 and following. For many in Judah were bound by oath to him. To who? Many in Judah had promised their allegiance to Tobiah. They backed the wrong guy. God wasn't behind Tobiah. And it goes further. It says, because he was the son-in-law of Shechaniah, the son of Era, and his son Johanan had taken the daughter of Mahalam, the son of Berechiah, as his wife. So you got all this intermixing and marrying and these family relationships with the wrong guy. And it would be bad enough if it stopped there, but look at the end of this chapter. And it says, also they spoke of his good deeds in my presence. Now think about that for a minute. The nobles are talking about the good deeds of whom? Tobiah, in the presence of Nehemiah. Why? What's going on there? Even though the wall is finished. Yeah, what's going on there?
They're trying to put him in fear.
Yeah, they're trying to undermine Nehemiah and put him in fear so that things don't keep going forward for the people of Israel, for the Jews here. And even that, it says at the end of there, and Tobiah sent letters to make me afraid. And I skipped one phrase there. They spoke of his good deeds in my presence and reported my words to him. So what's going on at the end of this wonderful Hallmark ending? Satan's under attack. Satan's attacking again through Tobiah. And the people that are supposed to be the people who are Nehemiah's friends and close co-workers are aligned with Tobiah. And not only are aligned with him, but they're coming to Nehemiah to discourage him, telling him how wonderful Tobiah is. And then on top of that, anything Nehemiah says, what are they doing? You know, I don't know. They must have sent letters. If it was nowadays, they'd have pulled out their phone and texted. He said this. He said that. You know, tweeted it out. Here's what's going on by Nehemiah. Why are they doing that? Yeah, to discredit him, to discourage him, to give Tobiah all the ammunition they can to try and come back at him. And what's the lesson in all of that for us? Keep your eyes on the Lord, and especially at what times? At times of great victory, we need to still keep our eyes where? On the Lord. Remember what was said to Israel? I didn't look up the verses, but what was told to Israel? When you come into the land and things are going well, don't what? Don't forget your God. Because when things are going well in our lives, we're not as often driven to prayer as we are when they're difficult, are they? And look at Nehemiah. Nehemiah's been praying for everything he's worth since he started this project. Why was that? This project was beyond him. These problems were way beyond what he wanted to deal with. This was beyond his expertise. And so he kept praying to God, and suddenly the project's finished. And if we're not careful, the point that happens there is we just give up praying to God because it's done. You think of Elijah. When was Elijah attacked the most fiercely? Remember Elijah on Mount Carmel? Stood against all those prophets. One man against all the prophets of Baal. God vindicates him. Sends down that fire, burns up his offering. All of those prophets are killed. Elijah should be having a party that night. And what happens? Yeah, one woman said, I'm going to get you for this. And what did he do? He ran. Why did he run from one woman when he didn't run from hundreds of prophets? Well, yeah, we won't go that. I wasn't thinking like that, John. Now quit that snickering. But, you know, at the time of greatest victory, he was most vulnerable because he expected it to be a Hallmark ending. And if Nehemiah had been like that, the rest of the book would just crumble, but we're going to see wonderful things in the rest of this book because Nehemiah is going to go from building the wall to building the people up to where the people needed to be, to giving them what God wanted them to be. And Satan and Tobiah didn't want that either. And so there's a great project still in front of Nehemiah, and he's still being attacked. And when we see God work in our lives, even when we hit those mountaintops, can I tell you, just beware. Because Satan doesn't get discouraged and say, well, give up on that one. That's a spiritual giant. I'll never make progress there. Because he's attacked some of the spiritual giants throughout Scripture, and they've fallen at the time when they should have been least vulnerable. They were the most. So beware. Looking at this, the great thing about it is the wall was finished. God did what he said he would do. And as we leave this morning, we can remember in our lives, God will continue to provide and do exactly what he said he could do. Not just for our benefit, but for his glory. And oh, that people would look at our lives this week in our church and say, I know how that happened. God did that. Let's pray. Father, we thank you again for this look at the book of Nehemiah, the way that you worked in his life. And Lord, I even thank you that Nehemiah didn't have an easy time of it because it teaches us so many things as we struggle through the difficulties and the challenges and the temptations of life. Lord, I pray that you'll help us to be like Nehemiah, trusting you, praying, taking things before you, letting you work, but then putting our hand to whatever it is that you'd have for us to do for our good and for your glory. For it's in Christ's name we pray. Amen.